New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we will be exploring the topic of psychonautics, the art and science of exploring the depths of human consciousness through a variety of techniques and processes, including mind-expanding drugs. My guest is Mike Jay. He is a cultural historian and author of many books, including Psychonauts, Drugs, and the Making of the Modern Mind, Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic, High Society, The Central Role of Mind-Altering Drugs in History, Science, and Culture, and Emperors of Dreams, Drugs in the 19th Century. Mike is based in England, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Mike. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
It's a great pleasure to be back, Jeff.
We're going to be looking at the question of, I guess you could say, self-exploration into the depths of consciousness using many techniques, but in particular, mind-altering drugs. And I really enjoyed the way in your book, Psychonauts, you go back into the history and actually go back really to the era of, in the 1600s, the founding of the Royal Society, where you had some of the leading figures of that era, people like the chemist Robert Boyle, one of the founders of the society and pillars of the society, experimenting on himself. Well, at the same time, the motto of the society is don't trust anything anybody tells you, basically, that self-experimentation was considered an inferior form of science, to put it mildly.
It was one of the things that inspired me to put Psychonauts together was, looking back into this history of self-experimentation, because, of course, in the psychedelic renaissance as we have it today, you know, our leading scientists, neuroscientists and pharmacologists are not telling us about their drug experiences. Quite the opposite. You know, science is now constituted very much around data and kind of brain imaging and objective facts rather than, you know, the experience itself. So what's interesting when you go back into history is to see how central self-experiment was. And as you say, this goes right back to the very beginning of what we think of as modern science, you know, the Royal Society in the 16th century. And as you say, how they distinguished themselves, what modern science was demonstrating everything by experiment, not taking anybody's word for it. You know, no longer are we looking at these old classical tomes and saying, well, Galen said this. We're trying it to see what happens when we try it ourselves. And from the very beginning, this was mostly, you know, as with Newton's experiments about prisms and light and rainbows, things that you could show to everybody. But from the very beginning, there were certain types of scientific data that only existed in the mind. And, people like Newton were interested in those as well. So when he was studying the eye and light and refraction, he got fascinated when he noticed that if he kind of poked and prodded at his eyeball, then he could get his finger behind it and he'd start to get these strange colours and distortions. Now, you know, he couldn't demonstrate these to everybody in the, lecture room of the Royal Society because they only existed inside his head. But nevertheless, they were important things to record, and he wrote down and demonstrated and explained what he'd done, that he'd poked like a kind of knitting needle behind his eye, and this is what he'd seen, and it was, you know, reflected, you know, the curvature of the eyeball and so on. So from the very beginning of science, this idea that if you really want to know something, you should try it on yourself, that was established. And then when mind-altering drugs kind of emerged and became interests of, you know, sort of subjects of curiosity, it was, you know, became pretty much standard practice. If you were interested in what this or that plant or drug did to the mind, and many people were for all kinds of reasons, then the first thing you would do would be to try it yourself and to describe the experience that you had.
As I understand it from your book, it was considered not only the first thing you would do, but the ethically imperative thing to do before administering a drug on another person would be to make sure it was safe on yourself.
Yes, that's right. Experiment was hard because it was considered unethical to experiment on patients. You know, there was the Hippocratic Oath. If you had a sick patient, you'd try and cure them. You wouldn't just give them something out of your curiosity to see what it did. So if you were taking things out of curiosity, you'd be the first experimental subject. You would be your own guinea pig, as scientists said later. And this also became very important when you were trying to describe drugs like, I talk about the discovery of nitrous oxide, for example, you know, that have a very, very powerful subjective experience that's very, very, you know, notoriously hard to describe. So chemists experimenting with things like that, you could get a certain amount of the way by trying them on animals, or you could kind of measure your own blood sort of pulse or heartbeat. But if you were talking about what these drugs did, you really had to be doing that from first person experience.
Because the experience inside the mind, the first person experience, philosophers refer to qualia, the color red, for example, the color blue, is a quality we experience in the mind, but nowhere else. It can't be measured externally. I mean, we can measure wavelengths, but if you measure a particular wavelength, you don't know that the person next to you sees the same color that you see when you're looking at it.
No, that's right. And the very best thing that you can do is to describe what you're experiencing, you know, what you're seeing and what you're hearing and what you're feeling. And so quite quickly in science, a kind of protocol developed, one that we're still very familiar with, which is kind of, 10:30 p.m. took, you know, 3 grains of this or 2 peyote heads or whatever, you know, 10:25 started to feel these, you know, that was about people self-experimenting and trying to say, to drill down and say, okay, what's different about my experience now from what it would be if I hadn't taken the drug? So you get that kind of level of sort of subjective description, first-person description, a level, of course, that we've lost from science. There is no first person in, you know, contemporary clinical science and medical science. But the first person, you know, it still remains the only way to describe certain things.
And I think it's important to mention that all of this is taking place in a cultural background of thousands of years of shamanism and thousands of years of mystical practices such as yoga and a variety of other meditative disciplines where first-person accounts was practically all they had to go on.
Our technologies for extracting objective data have got so much better in the last couple of hundred years. You know, we can now look at all these different types of brain scan, for example. But the first person experience is exactly what it's ever been. And it was, you know, you get these descriptions going way back into classical times and but they're very, you know, for the point of view of the sort of first generation of scientists, these were not really scientific data. They included all kinds of myths and legends and fantasies. So I think when Western science got going, self-experimentation took on a new, different dimension as a way of separating fact from fiction in those kind of traditional accounts.
Well, when it comes to mind-altering drugs in particular, Timothy Leary, if I recall correctly, described LSD as the equivalent of a microscope allowing you to look directly into the mind. The very word psychedelic means mind manifesting. The idea is that these drugs are ways to reveal the inner nature of the psyche, just like a telescope helps us to reveal the nature of the cosmos outside of us.
That got particularly interesting in the 19th century when people started to realize that the mind was not just, I mean, before that you had this idea that the mind is just the organ of reason and that's what it does. And then there are the instincts and the passions which are part of the body. Then I guess with Immanuel Kant and his separation of the world into the the world of our senses and the world behind it, we started to realize that in fact our picture of reality was constructed by our senses, and if we altered our sensory inputs we could change reality. And then through the 19th century people became more and more interested in the fact that there must be much more going on in the mind than we think. It's not simply rational and logical. There are different strands of thought and different things bubbling up in there, and things that we're not aware of kind of pop out to the front of our minds. And how does this happen? How do sensations turn into perceptions, turn into ideas? And once you got interested in those processes, then mind-altering drugs became fascinating because you could watch this process in yourself and tinker with your own sensations and perceptions.
I suppose it's fair to say that the earliest of the mind-altering drugs were the anesthetics that were used to stifle pain and eventually used in surgeries.
Yeah, that's right. If you go back to the classical sources, the early pharmacist Dioscorides, who kind of wrote about all these plants and catalogued them and their effects, they were the first ones he grouped together. He called them narcotics. And that was, I guess, the nightshades as well, things like Datura and Belladonna and Henbane. But yeah, opium as well. And they were the first. So in his kind of language, these were what he called cold drugs. A warm drug was something that brought you kind of further into the world and intensified your sensations. A cold drug was something that took you out of the world, like these narcotics did. The more you took of it, you first of all became calm, and then you became sort of sleepy and maybe fell asleep, and then it was coma and death. So that was how those anesthetics were originally conceived.
But some of the early medical doctors, I gather, really went to great lengths to push what the experience was like taking simple drugs like ether.
I mean, the great breakthrough of modern medicine, the discovery of surgical anesthesia, which was kind of in the sort of 1840s, actually was achieved with agents that had not been newly discovered by science. Nitrous oxide, which was used in dentistry, had been around for decades. And ether, as you say, went right back to the Renaissance, as far as you can tell, reading his kind of slightly cryptic writings. The alchemist Paracelsus had figured out how to synthesize ether from sulfuric acid and alcohol, and had tried it on animals. So, when this great breakthrough of modern science arrived. It arrived with these gases and volatile inhalants that had been familiar in the culture more broadly for decades and even centuries.
The really landmark instance would be the chemist Humphrey Davy and his experiments with nitrous oxide. They preceded the more famous experimentation of William James.
Humphrey Davy was a chemist, a young and brilliant chemist, who in 1799 was hired to work in a kind of medical research institution to synthesize all the various gases that were becoming available and see if they might have uses in medicine. So this was, you know, carbon monoxide and oxygen and other things, but also nitrous oxide, which nobody had inhaled up to that point. And it was believed to be toxic, but Davy, you know, self-experimenting, tried it and found that it produced this great rush of euphoria. And then kind of just as that was fading away, a sort of sense of cosmic revelation, a real feeling that he'd seen, you know, reality in a way that he'd never, ever seen it before. And then when he came back to normal consciousness, this was astonishing to him. How could it be that this gas that, as far as anyone knew, didn't exist in nature, only existed in the laboratory, how could a lungful of that produce these incredible effects on the mind and the spirit and the sense of spiritual revelation? You know, that was, you know, necessitated a complete rethinking of the relationship between the body and the mind.
And for our viewers who may not realize, nitrous oxide is also known by the more familiar name of laughing gas. And I remember being at the dentist and having it. I used to request it and pay extra for the dentist to administer it. And I recall being in a state of mind where I'd say to myself, now I know why they call it laughing gas. And that seemed like the funniest thing in the world to me at the time.
You know, many of us, certainly me, I mean, my first psychedelic experience would have been in the dentist's chair as a child. And that was, yeah, that nickname of laughing gas emerged because after Humphrey Davy's experiments, it was hard to find a medical use for this. He did suggest that it could be useful for surgical anesthesia, but since he was making it by heating ammonium nitrate, which is a very explosive chemical reaction, I can't imagine any surgeons of that time wanting this chemist tinkering around with explosive gases in their surgery. So it kind of became a curiosity, and people started demonstrating its effects in groups, scientific groups, and then in sort of public performances, you know, in kind of music hall theatres and carnivals. I guess a bit like if you think of the stage hypnotism shows we have today, you would get somebody, you know, somebody would come on stage with their barrel of nitrous oxide and say, if anyone's brave enough to inhale this, come along, and they'd give all the health warnings. And then somebody would come on stage and inhale some laughing gas and have this kind of crazy, wild, hilarious experience. And obviously, they, you know, they would act it out and, you know, just for the pleasure of the audience. So that was the context in which it first became known as laughing gas. And it was, that was also the context in which it made its way into surgery, because it was at one of these performances, a carnival in the, in New England, that there happened to be a dentist in the audience, and he saw the people inhaling nitrous oxide and laughing and having fits and dancing and stumbling around, and noticed that one of them had kind of gashed his shin really quite badly, but didn't seem to feel any pain. And that was the point at which Horace Wells, this dentist, thought, I could use that in my business, because, you know, there's a real limiting factor is people don't want to put up with the pain. So he decided to try nitrous oxide on himself and have a wisdom tooth removed.
Well, let's talk about William James. He's really one of the great pioneers. He's considered, I think, the father of American psychology, a pioneer in the field of psychical research, the discipline that preceded my field of parapsychology, and also the founder of the academic study of religion. In addition to that, he's considered one of the great pioneers of American pragmatic philosophy, a man of towering intellect who also took it upon himself to experiment with nitrous oxide.
Yes, he did. And I think his nitrous oxide experiment was, you know, very important for him. he came to it indirectly, you know, via the dentist's chair. He received a pamphlet that had been written by somebody about their anaesthetic experiences, the anaesthetic revelation, he called it, and said that this was a very powerful philosophical experience. And James was intrigued enough to try it himself in his laboratory at Harvard University, where he was at that time. And it was a transformational moment for him, I think, on many levels, because, as you say, he'd always been fascinated in mystical experience. His father was a Swedenborgian. He came from a mystical tradition, but he'd always been himself, thought of himself as rather a kind of dry, rational mind. He'd kind of thought, well, I'm never going to have one of these mystical experiences. So it was wonderful for him when he actually did have one on nitrous oxide, and he wrote down all these kind of strange bits of gibberish during and after the experience and submitted them to philosophical journals. And it was something that stayed with him. I mean, he quoted it again in, as you say, the Varieties of Religious Experience, which 20 years later, you know, the real capstone of his later career. And what he said about it there was that that was the moment he realised that our normal waking form of consciousness is just one among many. There are many different forms of consciousness, and and very many different experiences that you can have on mind-altering drugs. And it seems kind of arbitrary to disqualify them just because you had to take a drug to get them. An experience is an experience. And he insisted that you couldn't really have a thorough understanding of psychology and how the mind worked unless it could encompass all these different types of experience. So it became central to the sort of pluralism that was at the idea of the stream of consciousness, that our mind is not just simply kind of one thought after another, like train carriages. You know, there's all kinds of things going on all at once. Some may be very profound, some may be very trivial. Who knows quite where they come from? So that very expansive, generous Jamesian view of the mind, I think, his nitrous oxide experience was behind that for most of his career.
James was unique, I think, in his generation and his emphasis on consciousness, because after he died, I believe he died in 1910, that psychology took a different direction. The behavioral movement became dominant, and the idea that we could study consciousness at all went into a, you could say it became occulted. It went into the shadows for half a century, really. But during James' lifetime, he was very active in the Society for Psychical Research. And this is an organization that was looking at questions like altered states of consciousness, life after death, mind-to-mind communication. And I know in our previous interview, we talked about the society a little bit, and there were also esoteric societies like the Order of the Golden Dawn in the same period, magical societies using ritual as a way of exploring altered states of consciousness. And while these organizations did not encourage the use of mind-altering drugs, on the side, it seems as if the members of these organizations were psychonauts themselves. They were experimenting.
Yeah, it was obviously very interesting to them. I mean, I think James found a lot of common ground with the Society of Psychical Research, because he didn't really believe that science could explain these experiences. Certainly the infant science of psychology, which at that time was mostly based around, German researchers with brass instruments measuring attention and perception. You know, it was, they weren't really, this kind of subjectivity was beyond their ken. So he felt, well, this isn't really, science isn't going to get me far, but also I don't really want to put this in a religious or theological frame. For me, it's not about, you know, this was a genuine religious experience. I'm just interested in explaining it in ways that go beyond science and religion. And I think this was, you know, a very congenial attitude to the Society of Psychical Research, originally British, you know, figures like Myers and Sidgwick, although William James went on to be the chairman of the American chapter. And they were dealing with, you know, they were doing working a lot with seances and mediums and trying to capture these very odd events, you know, things like out-of-body experiences or communications from sort of beyond the grave. So drugs were kind of appealing in the sense that you could actually stimulate these experiences in a laboratory with prescribed doses. You know, this was a much more scientific way of going about things. Nevertheless, as you say, some of the members had qualms about recommending that people should take drugs because it, you know, but the ones who did had a very, very interesting range of experiences. Figures who approached it very scientifically and said, well, this is an extraordinary experience that I can't explain, but maybe it's just something that's, you know, it's just a glitch in my brain. It's something that happens when you inhale ether and sort of disconnect from the body. But there were other members of the Society of Psychical Research who were theosophists, for example, and they experienced the same thing, but their explanation of what was going on was that, well, we have a physical material body and we have a subtle body. And what's happening here is the material body is being suppressed and the subtle body, you know, which is, you know, what we experience maybe in dreams and seances and altered states of consciousness is allowed to rise up. So even within these organizations, when you had different people taking the same drug, they come up with very different ideas. And I think in the end, William James differed from the founders on the ground that they were very focused on using these kind of anomalous experiences to prove the existence of other realms or that demonstrate life after death. And in the end, James decided he was interested in these experiences for their own sake. He wasn't interested in using them as ammunition to prove this theory or that theory. For him, you know, they were real experiences. For him, they'd been very meaningful experiences and they changed his life. You couldn't say they weren't real, but they were just, for him, I think, part of a sort of natural phenomena of the world rather than, you know, a proof of something supernatural.
Do you think it would be fair to say that William James regarded his experience with nitrous oxide as an authentic mystical experience?
Yes, I think it would be fair to say that. It wasn't something that he repeated or went back to. Having done it once, he'd done it and that had answered his questions for him. So he didn't chase the buzz, as we would say today, and try and have more and more mystical experiences with it. But I guess by the end of his life, you know, he had decided, you know, in his radical empiricism, as he called it, he decided that every experience was genuine. There was no such thing as an experience that wasn't genuine. They were all experiences. And the universe in its totality was the sum of all these experiences. And trying to say that some of them were authentic and others were inauthentic was a fool's errand.
And his theory of radical empiricism, I think, in effect, is the philosophical basis for the very idea of psychonautics as a discipline.
Yeah, I guess it was definitely took him in a direction towards what became philosophy and away from what, as you say, psychology was on the point of becoming. But it also, I think, has some, you know, although it's far more cerebral, it has a lot of resonances with sort of ideas that you find in Amazonian shamanism, for example, of perspectivism, whereby the universe kind of reconfigures itself around the person who's perceiving it. So, you know, and that's pretty much what James was saying with his radical empiricism is, you know, there is a real world out there. It does all make sense. You know, it's a jigsaw with all the pieces you can be put together. But then, the way that the jigsaw pieces that I have to put together are different from the ones that you have to put together. And, you know, I think, you know, certainly phenomenologists and people who kind of try to really conceptualize the way that, you know, shamanic practices work, you know, that's the kind of explanation that they come up with for how people see the world in such a way that they could be a human, but they could also, in some situations, be a jaguar, and that jaguar could also be a human person.
I'm particularly fascinated by the example of the great poet William Butler Yeats and his lover or would-be lover, the woman he was infatuated with at the time, Maud Gonne. Both of these individuals became adepts in the Order of the Golden Dawn. They experimented with all types of magical rituals, and I gather they had some skill at out-of-body experiences and altered states of consciousness, and they used drugs, mind-altering drugs, methodically for these purposes.
They had a range of practices, quite a lot of which they'd learned at the Golden Dawn, where W.B. Yeats had been an adept. So they were familiar with spiritualism and the idea of theosophical thought forms, that there were abstract shapes and combinations of things that you could meditate on that would take you to the astral plane. Yeats was particularly fond of the Sanskrit idea of the tattva, and he had these little cards with different coloured geometrical shapes on, representing mind and body and spirit and so on. And he and Maud Gonne would use these often with hashish to get into a meditative state and to meditate on one's body and then one's soul within one's body and then fire within one's soul and opening up you know, a kind of gateway or portal to the astral plane where their minds could roam freely. And as Maud Gonne said, you know, the next morning you'd wake up and suddenly you'd have all these ideas and insights that would have appeared as a result. So it was a very kind of embodied spiritual practice, but it was also kind of, they had a psychological understanding of what was happening as well. And they were both quite unusual in their use of drugs. Maud Gonne particularly, an extremely courageous woman who ended up going to prison many times for her dedication to the cause of Irish nationalism against British colonialism. And there are very few women at that time who would write about their drug experiences, but you know, she describes all this in her memoirs, and you get a very good sense of how she is using these drugs to kind of expand the realm of subjectivity and enhance her immersion in this inner world.
And another person in that era of 19th century romanticism would be Coleridge, the great scholar and poet, Coleridge, who wrote this wonderful poem, Xanadu. In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. But he was, as you report, in spite of his obvious brilliance in many disciplines, he became an opium addict.
Yes, he did. And he, something that he was very ashamed of. Kublai Khan and Xanadu, he wrote that early on in his career, and those just staggeringly beautiful, transporting, early poems. So that was kind of really before the period when he, started taking opium regularly, which he did, you know, for a range of physical ailments, but also, as his friend said, because, you know, he was something of a hypochondriac, and he found it very easy to convince himself that he needed more and more opium. And this was something that Coleridge kept from his friends as long as he could. And the more he took opium, the harder I think it became for him to write those kind of beautiful, sort of free-flowing lyrical early poems. And he suffered a lot of writer's block, and what he wrote tended to be more kind of prosaic and theological and philosophical. And at the time of his real dependence on opium, his secretary was a young man called Thomas de Quincey, who also went through a similar trajectory with opium. But de Quincey decided that whereas Coleridge had been embarrassed and ashamed of his opium use and had kept quiet about it, de Quincey decided he was going to be open about it, and he exposed Coleridge rather cruelly in the process. But I think the way that de Quincey used opium and the way that he used it in as a literary and philosophical tool to lay out his, you know, his, you know, a picture of his mind and of his life, you know, is really the beginning of what we would call drug literature these days.
It also highlights the fact that these pioneers, individuals who are willing to experiment on themselves in this way, faced real risks. And certainly one of those risks was either addiction or drug dependency, or at least the risks of overdosing.
I mean, as we mentioned in our last discussion, the word drugs, the way they're using it now, the way that we're using it now, was kind of a 20th century term, and drugs back in those days just meant anything you could buy in a pharmacy. But even back in those days, there was a little bit of stigma associated with intoxicants generally, you know, and it was... it wasn't something that you kind of talked about in every kind of company, and they attracted a bad reputation for you know, people who took drugs continually became kind of quite dissolute, and it was seen as a moral failing. So all those things that that shadow the idea of drugs today were there at the same time as well. This was very much focused on opium to begin with, which everybody knew was addictive and had done since classical times. But actually, until Thomas de Quincey pointed it out and explained how addiction worked, it wasn't something that had preoccupied doctors greatly, because it was cheap and, you know, you could get it everywhere. It was just like having a medication that you have to take every day. You know, probably lots of us today are, you know, have medications that we are forced to take every day. And for doctors, the much more serious problem with opium was an overdose, you know. So the idea of addiction and its kind of moral and creative dimensions only really emerged after de Quincey, when then it was joined by all kinds of other drugs like ether, for example, and chloroform, and then cocaine, to which it was also possible to become, you know, to use regularly and to use too much and to become dependent.
Well, speaking of cocaine, we certainly need to talk about Sigmund Freud. I have heard it said that Freud literally turned on a great portion of European intelligentsia to the use of cocaine. Would you say that's accurate?
He was certainly instrumental in it. It would have happened without him, but in the early days of cocaine becoming a huge, you know, a pharmaceutical product in the 1880s, you know, it's real boom time. Then one of the, you know, primary sort of medical and scientific sources who was always quoted for it was Sigmund Freud. So he was in that kind of relationship that, you know, some of our scientists today might be thought of as, you know, being advocates for psychedelics. You know, he'd like that with cocaine. I mean, I think it's quite hard to approach the Freud story now, because, of course, we now know the famous Sigmund Freud, and we now have our very firm idea of what cocaine is. So we have to, you know, mentally erase that and go back to the time when Freud was a young researcher and cocaine was a new and little known drug. And I think if we do that, we get a very different picture. I think it's very easy to understand why he was so interested in it. It was a period when Everybody was looking for stimulants because the pace of life was accelerating through the Industrial Revolution. There were lots of these narcotics that we've mentioned and lots of new ones coming on stream, chloral hydrate and sedatives. But cocaine was something new. And in a world where lots of people were suffering from exhaustion and burnout, the idea of something that could give people more energy was very interesting. And I think Freud was right to be interested in it. But the fatal mistake, I think, that he made was he was a very sober and responsible fellow, and he only ever took cocaine as directed in very small doses. So he said, no, it's not addictive. You know, I've never felt any temptation to take more than the dose. And in fact, when I've had a little dose of it, I feel a slight revulsion at taking any more. So Freud was completely blindsided when it got out into the wider world, and people discovered that, especially if you were using these new hypodermic syringes to inject it, you could indeed take enormous amounts of cocaine and do yourself a great deal of damage very quickly. But I think Freud's failing was not, as he's often portrayed, that he became a cocaine addict, or, you know, but it was actually the opposite. He was too cautious and didn't see the dark side of cocaine until it was too late.
We're almost at a point in history where it's important to bring up the psychonauts that I think are most important to our viewers today, and those are the pioneers of psychedelic.
Mm-hmm.
Experimentation, and one of the first names to come to mind would be Aldous Huxley.
You can see how much that first generation of people like Huxley, who with Humphrey Osmond coined the word psychedelic, how much they looked back to previous sources, how influenced Huxley was by William James, how closely, before he wrote The Doors of Perception, he read the description of the effects of peyote by Havelock Ellis, who was a British psychologist and art critic, who in the 1890s was one of the first people here in Britain, the first person here in Britain, I think, to take peyote and to describe the mescaline experience. So I think with figures like Huxley, what you see is that, you know, we talk about the psychedelic renaissance now, or renaissance, but the 1950s and 1960s, when it first appeared, that was also a renaissance. It was a renaissance of something that had, you know, been part of Western science and culture, and then just in the early years of the 20th century had been suppressed, and they were bringing it back again. And for Huxley, what was it? I mean, he had been, you know, very profoundly interested in mystical experience for some time. But he had, for most of his career, believed that drugs were not a path to it. You know, and he was writing, you know, even in the early 1950s, you know, the drugs are not a path to enlightenment. They're a form of slavery. You know, any brief insights they might give you will be immediately swamped by all the negative effects, and you'll become drugged and dissolute and, you know, don't do drugs, kids. And so he was a believer in the mystical experience long before he was a believer in drugs. And I think what mescaline did when he took it was it completely changed his mind. And I think that's why he felt the need to come up with a new word. You couldn't really call mescaline a drug, because drug for him had all these associations of you know, being a kind of sedative and sort of mind numbing. And this was completely the opposite. And it also wasn't what the psychiatrist said it was, which was a psychotomimetic or something that mimicked the effects of schizophrenia or psychosis. So he said, we need a new word that connects this new type of drug to mystical experience and personal growth. And that's when he and Osmond put their heads together and came up with the word psychedelic, to come up with a term that had all those positive associations that the word drugs was too pejorative to capture.
Huxley himself would not have been in favor of the vast wave of drug use that began in the 60s, that was really promoted by people like Timothy Leary, Turn On, Tune In, and Drop Out. Huxley, to my understanding, felt that this was something that should be reserved for elite thinkers such as himself and perhaps his friend Gerald Hurd.
Yeah, I think that was how he saw it. And I think that was, you know, we got a lot of talk about the Eleusinian mysteries in psychedelic discourse. And that, you know, really before the idea that, you know, they might have contained a psychedelic, you had people like him and, as you say, Gerard Hurd and a lot of other people saying, this is a model for how we should roll out psychedelics in our society. Just, you know, we should just pick the best and the brightest, you know, the cream of the young people, and we should take them off and initiate them and to kind of teach them and understand, you know, so that they can understand what's, you know, this is like and get their insights from it, and they can then guide society, you know, in a more positive direction. So, yeah, it was a very paternalistic idea. And actually, I think that early generation of the first generation of psychedelic enthusiasts in the 1950s mostly felt that way. That was the way they saw it. And it was when Timothy Leary and others joined it that, you know, they found this too elitist and thought, well, we should just, you know, who are we to say who should and shouldn't have this experience? We should just roll it out and see where it goes. But I think for Huxley, the idea was that you could give, that it was a kind of instant zen, that you could give anybody a pill and they'd have a profound mystical experience. That wasn't the way he saw it at all. I mean, for him, it was, this was something that had to be cultivated, and one had to have a appreciation of an experience of what he called the perennial philosophy, you know, what he regarded as the kind of ultimate truth behind all the world's religions. And, you know, that was what, you know, if you were on that path, then psychedelics, you know, could open those doors for you.
Now, I was first introduced to Aldous Huxley when I was a high school student, long before I'd ever even given a thought to drugs of any kind, not even cannabis. And at that time, his great novel, Brave New World, seemed to be a very harsh and penetrating critique of the modern world altogether, particularly modern technology of all kinds. And earlier you mentioned how Freud's use of cocaine was in some way a reaction to the booming industrial age that was taking place at the end of the 19th century, that drugs were seen as sort of an antidote to the evils of society itself.
That's true, but I think for Huxley's generation of progressives in the early 20th century, these were the people, as you said, growing up with behaviorism as their model of the mind. They saw drugs as, you know, the way that we might see, you know, that alcohol is viewed today as actually the product of big business and a mass industrialized society. And that these were things that were given to the masses to keep them quiet and stop them thinking for themselves. And I think that's how Huxley sees Soma in Brave New World. You know, it's part of this culture of, you know, mass production, mass employment, mass entertainment, which he associates with people like Henry Ford. And, you know, how do you keep all the workers happy? Well, you just give them this dose of something that kind of makes them sort of happy in a very vacuous way. And, you know, it's just that stimulates their pleasure centers without really having any spiritual content. And that was the way that a lot of progressive people saw drugs at that time. And that was the way that Huxley saw them for most of his life. So it's interesting in Brave New World. I found this as well when I went back to it, having read it much younger, as you did, that he's really not very interested in what Soma does. He doesn't describe the effects. He just talks more about the rituals and how it's used in this repressive society. And then people go into their Soma haze and then they come out the other side. So, and that, you know, we forget now because of Huxley's become such a great sort of guru to the psychedelic era. We forget that for most of his life, that was his view of drugs. And it was only really in the last few years that he became the man we remember.
I think we need to bring up, of course, Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, and their younger colleague, Ralph Metzner, and their great book, The Psychedelic Experience. That seemed to me to be a milestone in what the idea of psychonautics could accomplish, the integration of the experience itself with the ancient Tibetan literature in the Book of the Dead.
That was a kind of, I guess, the first serious attempt to instrumentalize psychedelics, to use them as a technology to reach a particular effect. So it's like, okay, if we do this, this is the guidebook or the handbook, as it were. But I think what I've tried to do in Psychonauts is to, we have our, you know, we talk about kind of the great men theory of history. You know, that's kind of idea that history is all about Napoleon and Wellington and Churchill. And I think, you know, psychedelic history is a little like that as well. And in the same way, we can, you know, we can look behind the great men and see how much had changed and what had to change in order for their experiences and for their teachings to be valuable. And I think you know, things changed enormously fast in the 1950s and 1960s. We moved away from this behaviorist view of the mind, you know, that individual experience wasn't interesting. We had, I mean, this is something we associate with psychologists like Abraham Maslow and the idea of the hierarchy of needs and peak experience. Of course, peak experience was the language that, you know, early psychedelic users sort of glommed onto very early on to describe what a psychedelic experience was. So I think behind the big figures is a much bigger kind of trend in society generally, as well as in, you know, psychology and the mind sciences, to see, you know, the human mind and inner experience as something important and worth cultivating. You know, figures like Jung and the idea of individuation, the idea that we need to somehow become who we are and have a set of experiences that bring us to the point where we are ourselves and uniquely ourselves, and that this is an important part of human satisfaction. So I think that was the wave that these early figures like Leary and Alpert crested and showed people how you could use psychedelic drugs to do that.
Well, you've brought up Carl Jung, and these days people are familiar with his Red Book. It was kept secret for decades by his family, but it reveals his own, and I'd have to call it a psychonautic exercise, although I don't believe we have any evidence that Jung used psychoactive medicines of any sort. He used a process he called active imagination to enter into a dreamlike state, very, very similar to the accounts of people using drugs.
I mean, we were talking about W.B. Yeats and Maud Gonne and their practices. I think that's and that's actually the milieu in a way that Jung came out of, because his family were kind of Christian theosophists and mystic, and he brought a lot of that with him before he even entered psychology and psychoanalysis. He was very cautious about psychedelics. He was particularly cautious about them once psychiatrists started getting hold of them and giving them to patients. He saw them as this sort of, you know, rather dangerous new toy that the you know, the psychiatrists had now got hold of, and he was concerned about their dangers, and also you know, believed that you know, there was no instant Sartori there to be had. You know, this is they weren't really shortcuts to anything. So I don't think they, because of his orientation, where he came from, I don't think they appealed to him particularly. But yeah, the kind of practice that he went through is the kind of practice that you know, a lot of people around the world today follow, you know, with or without the use of psychedelics, I guess.
We're entering into an era today where these drugs are being decriminalized, psychedelics in particular, certainly cannabis. And there's a situation in which psychonauts, people who want to experience this window into the realms of human consciousness can do so, and do it in a team with experimental researchers. You have people now taking psilocybin in the laboratory at Johns Hopkins University and the University of London and elsewhere. People are working together with scientists so that they can engage in objective measurements and subjective reports simultaneously. Here in New Mexico, where I live, some of the earliest research on DMT was done at the University of New Mexico here in Albuquerque.
That's right, by Rick Strassman, who was a real pioneer in this psychedelic renaissance that we're now in the middle of. This was what kind of prompted me to look back at the idea of self-experimentation, because it's still the case that when people write scientific papers, they don't write them in the first person and say, I took this drug and I had this experience. For a long time, it was about subjects in laboratories on psychedelics being wired up to monitors and brain imaging machines and so on. And we're now starting to find a little bit more qualitative work where the researchers are sitting down together with people having the experience and asking them about it and including a bit more of their subjective sense of the experience. But it's very much something that, where the real clinical work happens at arm's length. And I was interested in how different that is as a science and as a scientific approach. And also the strange paradoxes that what we're interested in is subjectivity and the subjective experience. But we're kind of trying to get to that, by proxy, by all these proxy measurements of the objective data that we can extract. So I don't advocate that every researcher doing psychedelic science should be taking psychedelics themselves. I think it's up to them, and I think it's a difficult balance. In fact, there have been studies that show that if people knew that the researchers had been taking psychedelics themselves, they would trust the results less. So I think there are good arguments for psychedelics, as we know, make people very suggestible. And I think this is still, however objective and careful we are with scientific research, this is a problem that we see quite a lot in sort of psychedelic research, that pretty much any question you ask about psychedelics, to subjects on them, the answer will be yes. I think I remember speaking to Charles Tart back in the day. He did this in the 1960s. He did a set of experiments with cards where he would ask questions of people on LSD, and he's like, or he'd put statements like, the top of my head feels hot, and everyone could, yes, And at the end of the experiment, you'd have a huge pile of yeses. So I think even if we kind of exclude subjectivity, we still have a subjective bias in the psychedelic research, which is, combined with the financial incentives and who's funding the research. I mean, how is it that in the 1990s, all the scientific research about MDMA said that, it kind of destroyed your dopaminergic neurons and put Swiss cheese holes in your brain. And now all the research on MDMA is incredibly positive about, its sort of beneficial social and therapeutic qualities, So I think we're still... I think, what we've got to is a situation where people are hungry for the subjective experience in ways that don't emerge directly from the science. And I may have sort of said this last time. I think that's, if you look at the work of someone like Michael Pollan, I think that's really why that's so valuable and why he's so enormously popular, is that people are fascinated to read about, how this or that drug might affect this or that neurotransmitter in the brain. But what people really want to know is, what's it like, And so you get people like Michael who are not strictly scientists, but kind of outriders of the science, providing, these subjective experiences that contextualize it and color it and bring it to life.
You also wrote about Alexander Shulgin, who has written two monumental thick books about his experimentation with his wife of a large variety of variations on different psychedelic compounds.
Alexander Shulgin was absolutely fascinating because he was a very principled self-experimenter. He believed that if you were a psychopharmacologist and you were making these drugs, phenethylamines or tryptamines, then there was the chemical synthesis that was very important and you got to your white powder or crystal. But then the self-experiment was an essential part of this. It was an equal part because there's no way you can tell by looking at a white powder or even by looking at its molecular structure what effect it's going to have on the brain. So he did that and he worked out a very systematic way of doing it together with his wife Anne and with a sort of a bunch of other experimenters. They developed a kind of protocol for rating the effects of drugs subjectively to combine that with all their chemical practice. And of course, Shulgin could do this because he wasn't trying to make money out of these. He wasn't trying to license these drugs that he was making. He wasn't trying to patent them. He was just working in his laboratory, you know, so he had no kind of complicated corporate sponsors or ethical protocols. And I think what's so fascinating about those two door-stopping books of Alexander Shulgin is that for all the different compounds he describes, there are two parts of the description. The first part is what he calls the chemical synthesis, and the second part is what he calls the subjective extension. So he starts off by describing the synthesis and then has little quotations of, well, at 35 milligrams, you know, this was what it felt like, and at 50 milligrams, this is what it felt like. And if you go right back to the beginning of this, to Humphrey Davy and his nitrous oxide experiments, the big door-stopping book that he wrote was exactly the same. It started with all the chemical synthesis, and then it went on through the physiology, you know, how much of the gas is absorbed into the bloodstream, you know, what happens if you give it to frogs or rats. But then he finished with what Shulgin would have called subjective extensions, with people like Samuel Coleridge giving their descriptions of the effects of the gas. And seems somehow that you have to put these two things together. They're mutually unintelligible. You can't translate chemistry and pharmacology into literature and poetry and philosophy, but somehow you can, if you put the two of them together, then you get the whole picture.
Mike, I wonder if you have any vision or even hypothesis regarding the future of psychonautics as a discipline?
That's a really good question. I think it's not clear yet what psychonautics as a discipline could be. I think our first impulse is always to instrumentalize them. So where it's either to turn them into tools of medicine, you know, and you know, it's, increasingly we're seeing them also being treated as tools of religion, you know, spiritual technologies, sacraments, psychedelic churches forming around particular compounds. And I think there's something beyond that, which is, you know, just taking the experience on its own terms, not trying to press it into service, you know, either medical or spiritual. But because it's very, very hard to contain psychedelics within those boundaries. I think they have great utility within all these disciplines, but you can't put them in that box and say that's where they belong. So I very much hope that, you know, as William James would have wanted, we have a future in which all kinds of uses and all kinds of experiences are possible, and that psychedelics can, rather than being a discipline of psychonautics in itself, it can be something that informs our culture and our science right across the board.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. Once again, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I'm quite sure that a percentage of our viewers are psychonauts themselves in their own way. And I have been throughout most of my adult lifetime.
Well, me too.
I think drugs have been very instrumental in my interest in human consciousness and in the far reaches of human nature, a term I think Abraham Maslow used in the title of one of his books, that we have a lot to discover about what it means truly to be a conscious human being.
I think that's right, and I'm glad for that reason that these experiences are not so heavily stigmatised as they were. It doesn't mean to say that we should believe these drugs have magical properties and no dangers, because clearly that's not the case. But I think, I think it contributes to our cultural conversation. And I think the fact, it's increasingly it becomes possible for more and more people to have these kinds, of very exceptional experiences, and to have them in the context of a culture that is not condemning them or throwing people in jail for it, but interested in those experiences and in sharing them and in spreading them. I'm also optimistic about that, and grateful for those experiences that I've had, throughout my adult life too.
Well, Mike, once again, thank you so much for being with me. It's been a real pleasure to share your vast knowledge with the New Thinking Aloud audience.
It's been a great pleasure to return, Jeff. Thank you very much indeed.
And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.